which was the epitome of a highly developed culture, a very depraved culture at that. It was a very resistant field. You get the point? Well, Antioch was just that. The city of learning, wealth, and it was a high culture in the sense of being a long-standing, fully integrated, fully developed, very wicked. And yet that's where Paul went. Look out of there. By the way, I think Jesus said that the gospel is going to all the world. I think we ought to understand that. The gospel goes to all the world. Well, any questions on what I've been saying? Okay, one more. Another thing I pointed out, this is an ancient historical view where history will help us understand scripture, is that the people of Antioch were known by the ancients for their bitter satirical wit. They were not a delightful people. They were known for having developed the art of ridicule. What's this comedian, Don Rickles? Don Rickles, I think it's hilarious. He would have been right at home there. You know, his thing is ridicule. And of course it's all been in fun, but he's developed this art of ridicule. He comes out and then they play the theme from El Toro, you know, the here he comes, and he starts immediately to insult the band, he insults the crowd, you know, and that's his approach, that's his thing, and I think he does very well, so anyway, it shows a serious defect in my moral character, but I never claim to be spiritual anyway. But he comes out and he realizes, you know, did you ever see him in action? Well, the least special one was that. But he came out and just, you know, proceeded to jump on everybody, and it wasn't funny. Well, this, he would have been right at home in Antioch. The Antiochans were famous for name calling, giving nicknames to people, ridiculing them. Now, it's interesting, where were the disciples first called Christians?
Antioch.
Now, let's be careful here. I have my mentor, Dr. Yamaguchi, I can find an evangelical scholar at my university in Marshall, Ohio. He thinks that the name Christian was a pejorative, that is a sarcastic nickname given to the disciples by these Antiochans who were known for bestowing nicknames upon groups or upon individuals. He thinks it's highly significant that the Christians were called, simply called Christians in this city, which was known for giving nicknames. In other words, he thinks it was an insult. It was a pejorative, that is, it's not, you know what the word pejorative means? It's college. Pejorative means, it's the opposite of honorific. Now you know. Well, you can see the word honor there, don't you? An honorific title is an honor, is a title that is a compliment. A pejorative is the opposite. Negative put down. And it's a very good word. Y'all learn what it means. I think when you go through 4 years of college, y'all learn at least one or two new words. Anyway. This can be year two. Honorific and pejorative, they're opposite. They're antonyms. You know what antonym means. The opposite is synonym.
I don't know.
Anyway. I love it for those in the work, because you learn these two out there, especially about anything. He said it was a pejorative term, a negative term, because they were known for this, and it stuck, and became honorific. It was a pejorative nickname given that became honorific. So Peter would later say, if any man suffers a Christian, let him what? Not be ashamed. Now, I think my little professor is wrong on this. There's a book by Hunt, Julian Hunt, probably published, which says, which is an interesting book called Christian is the Name of the Church. It doesn't mean Christian Church is the name of the church, but Christian is the name. This name Christian is prophesied of God, and that he says that the name, the word, the Greek word for called, the Christians were called, the disciples were called Christians, the special word indicates called by God, a divinely given name. I'm not sure you can defend that. I think that's up for grabs. But he makes a very good point in that, in his book, that there's no evidence whatever that this name was ever given as an insult. And therefore, I think that you ought to know the possibility that this is what's being said, and that it was a, found that Christian was an insult given to the church, which they took and turned around and made honorific, made a compliment. I don't think so myself.
It may be true. Maybe my professor is right.
But I don't think so, because of two reasons. First of all, there is no indication whatever in Scripture that this term Christian was ever an insult. Okay? There's no indication that the term Christian was ever an insult of any kind. I said what Peter said, if any man serves a Christian, I'll not be ashamed. The second reason is that the name Christian is not pejorative in and of itself. That is, if the Antiochans, who are known for their creativity in making up these pejorative nicknames, they sure missed the boat on this one, because there's nothing to say that Christian means what? Belonging to Christ. You're a bunch of people who belong to Christ. Now, if they were going to insult the church by giving them a nickname, they sure picked a bad one. And I think they would have known it. You got what I'm saying? There's nothing particularly insulting about saying that. If they were going to label the Christians in a negative way so as to ridicule them, they would not have picked this name out of that. Because that is, the Christians never would have been embarrassed by that, would they? There's nothing, it would have been something much more deadly, much more negative, much more dirty, perhaps. It would have been something that really was insulting. But the name Christian is not insulting, no matter who. So they would say, well, you belong to Christ. Ha, ha, put you down. No, that's not a put down. And would never be considered by anybody, but for that reason as well, I'm of the opinion that this is a coincidence that they were called Christians first. And that may not be. It may be that it was an attempt to slander them, which the Christians turned around and used for their benefit. However, I myself do not think so.
I think maybe because they were converts in that city, that part of their way of life, they just kind of in other words, they're probably used to having names or something, but instead of being, you know, ridiculing themselves.
Well, I don't think so. What I'm saying, that's an interesting suggestion. Because these Christians have been in the habit of being part of a culture that gave nicknames, they just gave themselves a good nickname. That's a very interesting point, very excellent observation. I don't think so. You may be right. It's just maybe a good suggestion, but I think it's a coincidence that they were called Christians first and now, because that sort of be the natural meaning. And the Bible, the Old Testament said that the new covenant people were going to be called by a new name. And disciples was much too general. Any religion could have disciples. The disciples of Plato.
Yeah. Didn't Isaiah say after the Gentiles seen righteousness, they would receive a new name?
Yes, that's prophesied. Now, well, this was it, exactly what it was meant. This is what Mr. Hunt says in his book, that this was the name that was prophesied. You may be right. Huh? Yeah. So I may be disappointed. I don't picture the Antiochans giving, the enemy is giving that. It's sort of a natural name to grow, to apply to the church. And maybe not. Could be that it was. It could be in some way, Jack, in some way, this thing of this name being given came out of, grew out of the Antiochian proclivity for giving nicknames. And if that happened, it does not mean it could not be a prophesied name. All that God said is they're going to be given a new name. He didn't say exactly how it's going to come about, so not necessarily, those ideas are not antithetical, but they're not mutually exclusive. It could both be true. This was a name given in a city that was like to give nicknames, and that this is God that they prophesied it. So that could be. Many questions, but this is a very, very important city. The disciples were called Christians first in Antioch. Any, my watch is stopped. Speak to me.
Because of his misrule, misconduct, Augustus had removed or deposed Archelaus and put Judea under governor, who was responsible to the legate of Syria, headquarters of Antioch of North, and his son, Agrippa the First, who's a good friend of what Roman Emperor? Caligula. Judea was once more under a king, Agrippa the First. However, with the death of Agrippa the First, Judea went again under a governor. I made the statement, if you recall, that the Herod before whom Paul appears after his imprisonment is Herod Agrippa the Second. But I said to you, he was king in name only, that he reigned, did not rule. It was an honorific title. He was called king, but actually he had no, he was a flunky in the Roman government, but did not actually rule. He was neither fish nor fowl. But Judea was under the governors again, I was saying Agrippa the Second was king, but remember I made the point when I was covering that material that he was king in name only. He had no actual administrative rule, the title. He was a royal family. He had courtesies extended to him, but he didn't rule over anything.
That was 44.
Yeah, AD 44 is when Agrippa the First died. Okay. So Judea fell once again to governors. That is under Herod the Great, under Archelaus, under governors, under Agrippa the First, under governors, under Agrippa the Second, having the title of king but no authority, right over authority. Actually, on my government. Yeah. Aren't you glad they made things so easy for us? All I said is that the people of ancient history had no consideration whatever for modern historians. They acted in a very complicated way. Well, anyway, the atmosphere of Palestine in the first century, all through the first century, crackled with unrest. There were messianic revolts before the time of Jesus. We've already talked about the fact that there were many attempts to get Jesus to lead a messianic revolt, a zealot revolt. There were many after. Matthew 24, Jesus said, "Beware, because many false messiahs are going to come." And they came. This unrest, somebody read Luke 13, 1 and 2 for us. Let's go quickly. Ed, Ed finds out. Acts 5, 36 and 37. Monday, we'll let you read that to us. And Acts 21, 38. You also have a copy of the Bible. Mark 1, 2. Luke 13, 1 and 2.
Now on the same occasion there were some present who reported to him about the Galilean, whose blood Pilate had mingled with his sacrifices. And he answered and said to them, "Do you suppose that these Galileans were greater sinners than all of the Galileans who held their stuff at this place?"
Okay, this text reflects an event, a minor revolt, by the Galileans. So the Galilee was a hotbed of revolt. And here, during the reign of Pilate, there had been a revolt in Galilee, which had been very cruelly put down, led by a false messiah. Okay, Acts 5.
"For some time ago, Judas rose up claiming to be somebody, and a group of about 400 men joined up with him." Okay. "And he was slain."
Okay, this is a mention of one Judas, another minor messianic revolt. And Mark?
"And you were not the Egyptian who some time ago served the revolt and led 4,000 men of the assassins out of the wilderness?"
Okay, now I don't have time to go into all of these, but mention of three separate events, minor revolts stirred up, which the Romans would promptly put down. Now, we've read three from the scriptures. We look now to the Jewish historian of the first century, Josephus, of course, and we find him mentioning one. And remember, who read Thutis? Steve, did you read the one about Thutis? Okay. Josephus also mentions him. He says, "Now it came to pass that while Thutis was procurator of Judah, a certain magician whose name was Thutis persuaded a great part of the people." to take their effects with them and follow him to the River Jordan. For he told them he was a prophet and that he would have. Well, now let me say that there is not general agreement that this is the same Thutis. It's a historical question with some real problems, which I don't have time to go into, but I'm fair to tell you that it's not unanimously admitted that this is the same Thutis. But that's not important. The point I'm making here is that there were many of these messianic revolts. And listen to one of them.
this Thutis, if it is the same one, okay, if it's not okay, persuaded a great part of the people to take their effects with him and follow him to the river Jordan, for he told them he was a prophet, and that he would, by his own command, divide the river and afford them an easy passage over it. And they were deluded by his words. The kind of thing they were trying to get Jesus to do. He said he would do it. He'd go to the Jordan River and he'd be like the crossing of the Jordan River in the days of Joshua all over again. However, Thaddeus, the prophet or governor of Judea, did not permit them to make any advantage of his wild attempt. Read today. But sent a troop of horsemen and his cavalry out against them, who, falling upon them unexpectedly, slew many of them and took many of them alive. They also took Thutis alive and cut off his head and carried it to Jerusalem. So we'll never know if he actually could get the waters of the Jordan River to part. They intercepted him on the way. But see, the Romans, this helps us understand why Pilate could be persuaded to crucify Jesus during, ahead of schedule, as it were. The Romans were very good at putting down the revolts, and they knew that the sooner you put down a revolt, the easier it was. And so they were very good, adept at finding the leaders and killing them or imprisoning them, stopping, nipping at the bud, as we would say. And so they didn't wait for this Jordan River fiasco to take place. It would pick up too much momentum, tell them what would happen, so they headed them off. And then got there and took his head, cut his head off, took it to Jerusalem, put on display as an example. There were a group of, Josephus tells about this, won't take time to read it, a group of Jews, or a class of Jews, or a bunch of Jews. It's quite a staccari, which means the knife men. And these were revolutionaries who, especially during the feast days, Passover, Pentecost, there were great crowds in Jerusalem. They would mingle with the crowd, and they would locate certain Jewish leaders whom they considered to be collaborators with the Romans, and simply assassinate them. They would hide a sharp knife in their cloak, and they would, in this jostling, shifting, pushing crowds, they would move up next to someone, pull a knife out, step between their ribs, and slip back into the crowd. And many Jewish leaders in the Jewish community who either were collaborators with the Romans or were suspected of being collaborators with the Romans were assassinated. This is during the days of Jesus and later by these knife men, the Sicarii. They were assassins. Yes.
Is this part of the 4,000 assassins referred to in Acts 11?
No.
That they tried to...
No, probably not. This was not a ever since these were just like an underground movement or a secret society, yes.
Like a clan or something?
Yeah, well, they unless it's known about them, they were an organization of assassins, but they were an underground movement.
I didn't hear what you call them.
Sicarius. It means the ninth men, literally. Well, in AD 66, but what I'm saying is, say, roughly between the, all through the days of Jesus, but they begin to intensify, say, in the years between AD 40 and AD 65, these movements begin to pick up. That is, there was a great deal of agitation against the Romans on the part of the Jews. In AD 66, a wholesale revolt broke out. The occasion was the governor at that time, who was Florus, F-L-O-R-U-S, he seized 17 talents of silver, a very large sum of money, from the temple's treasury. And this was one thing the Jews would not tolerate. They fought almost anything. What sparked the rebellion under Judas Maccabeus against the Syrians? What did he do?
When he took the money,
he sacked the temple and desecrated it and offered the pig on the altar. Same thing again. The Jews, if you wanted to get itself a Jewish revolt, you just mess with the temple. And this governor Florus, right? Now this was not the only event. This was at the end of a string of events which infuriated the Jews some, most of them justifiably so. But when he went into the temple and took this money, there was a general revolt. Not everybody was involved. Many, there was, most of the Jews weren't. But there was a large revolutionary element, and it was tested out, and much of it was spontaneous, much of it was organized, much of it was confused. But with AD 60, say you can talk about a general Jewish revolt.
What was that governor's name?
Flores, F-L-O-R-U-S.
Stolen?
Yeah, just went in and took it. He needed it and took it. 17 pounds, which is a lot of money. Now, and so Nero, we've already studied, he sent Vespasian, who was an emperor who followed Nero, Otho, Galba, and Vespasian, three short emperors, rules after Nero. But anyway, Nero sent Vespasian to Galilee, or to Judea, to Palestine, to put down the revolt. This was an army. An army brought up from Caesarea. Vespasian, in AD 67, another, they dealt with Galilee first. Galilee was, as I said, a hotbed of revolt. And they put down the revolt in Galilee. And it is here that Josephus was drawn to over to the Roman side. He had been sent up there to talk the Galileans into surrendering, a group of them, and he did not go over to the other side, I've already said. And he had in the suicide pact, and he alone survived. You know, he got a new straw, he got the last straw. He did. He ingratiated himself to the Romans by predicting, interestingly enough, that Vespasian would become emperor, which did not seem likely at that time. Very interesting thing in history, if we can believe Josephus, and there's no reason not to, and it's true, it's very strange, that there would have been no reason to believe that Vespasian would have been made emperor. And yet Josephus, when he surrendered to Vespasian's forces, predicted, or told Vespasian that he was something of a prophet, and he predicted that he would be emperor. Vespasian liked that prophecy. And so he spared Josephus' life and actually became his patron. Josephus was sent to Rome, and there, like in later years, and sometime after this, after the dust settled, and it was there that he wrote his famous History of the Jews, the Antiquities, and then the Jewish Wars, justifying or explaining the Jewish nation to the Romans, basically. Now, so Vespasian conquered Galilee. Vespasian had other business back in Rome, plus he was going to be emperor, he had to get back and get the ball rolling. And so he left his son Titus to continue the war, putting down the revolt. What they did, they conquered several communities. We don't have time to go into them. Several, and Josephus tells about this one here at Syria, for instance. Several of these, there was a battle fought at Caesarea. Several of these minor, these communities were, the walled cities were subdued, and finally they arrived in Jerusalem, AD 70. You got that? In 67, their revolt was put down in Galilee, but it was not until 3 years later, a little over 2 years later, that these minor skirmishes, these revolts, but these pockets of resistance, we would call them, these walled cities, walled towns were put down, were subjugated. So they finally arrived in Jerusalem, AD 70.
What was his son's name?
Titus. So it was Vespasian, who was the general, who was sort of in charge. Titus was the Roman general who was there at the fall of Jerusalem. Now, Josephus goes into a great deal of detail about the fall of Jerusalem. He records how that first they conquered what he calls the first wall. It's the third Agrippa wall. Remember, I didn't make my transcript. Remember that wall to the north of Jerusalem called the third Agrippa wall? It's the third if you start counting from the center of the city. Josephus calls it the first wall. He tells about how, and we don't have time to read all this, he tells about how that the Romans brought in towers. Remember a tower. They put up this tower up near the wall on wheels, and they would put archers, those bowmen and spearmen, in behind shields in this tower, rolled up next to the wall, and they could, the idea was that they were higher than the wall, and they could keep the defenders off the wall long enough for the wall to be stormed by ladders from below. Very hard to storm a wall when you've got these characters looking down on you. Hot oil, and the Jews used hot oil, made the Romans very mad. One of the many reasons, if you read through Jews, one of the reasons that the Jews were treated so badly was these soldiers thought that was very unfair, unmanlike. That oil, it would be burning oil, and once it's like getting burning tar on you. Once it hit you, it just stayed and hung and burned and cooked you. And it's especially bad when you're wearing armor. Hot burning oil inside armor is a no-no. I mean, it's just a terrible thing. And so they plunged stones and, you know, all kinds of missiles. So it's very difficult, you know, very palpitating the wall. So what they would do, they'd bring these towers up against the wall to shoot down at the defenders to run them back if they could, while the men on the ground would try to batter down the doors, the gates, or batter the wall, or scale the ladders. Finally, they took the first. He tells about them taking the first wall, that is the third Agrippa wall. Then he tells about them taking the second wall. It's a very bitter fighting. And then finally, they come to the last wall. And I'll read some of Josephus. It's quite an extensive account. I recommend you read it sometime. You understand what Jesus said? Jesus used this prophetic formula. There's never been a rut, this time bad, this bad before, never will be this time this bad again. That's it. Not literally, to be taken literally. It's a standard formula found in the prophets indicating it would be very, very bad times. He said this, Josephus is there trying to talk the people into surrendering. But anyway, says, as for the people, they had great inclination to desert to the Romans. Well, they were starving to death. And it was not the majority of the people in Rome who wanted to hold out. The seditious, as Josephus calls them, as the revolutionaries wanted to. But there are many, many people, perhaps the majority, who wanted to open the walls, open the gates, and to surrender. Accordingly, some of them, those who wanted to desert, sold what they had, even the most precious things that had been laid up as treasures by them, as the family heirlooms, for a very small matter that they wanted to liquidate. So they really cut the prices and to get pieces of gold, to reduce their wealth to gold, to small pieces of gold, that they might not be found by the robbers. And when they had escaped to the Romans, went to the stool, and that's what they would do, they'd swallow them. They would just get out with their money. They knew that anything they left behind, the Romans were going to get. So they would swallow, they would sell it, reduce the price, sell it to what they could out of the gold, swallow the gold, desert to the Romans, and the Romans with their resort, and people left through the lines, so the gold they got it, you know, every friend Jew was out there, was one less Jew was in, and having to fight. And then they would go to the stool, as he says, to try to recover their money. Later on, I'm not going to take time to read, the Romans caught on to this. And so when people would surrender, they would simply cut them open and check to see if there was any gold. And then they had to have 100 for slit them open. Check the treasure boxes. That one, maybe we can see. Yeah, here it is. Here's the details of it. Let me read on. Anyway, they were trapped for Titus, let a great number of them go away into the country. It worked for a while. He just let them go, and they had this gold in their stomach. Whether they pleased, and the main reasons why they were so ready to desert were these, that now they should be free from those miseries which they endured in that city. A very miserable thing to be in a city in a time of siege. And yet should not be in slavery to the Romans. If they stayed there until the Romans got in, they would be made slaves. But Titus, in order to encourage as many as possible to surrender, to get out, he said, "You'll come on out," probably announced it.
I just spread the rumor. And if you don't, you wouldn't let you go. You can hunt in the hills. However, John and Simon, these were leaders of the revolutionaries, with their faction, did more carefully watch these men's going out than they did of the Romans, than they did of the coming in of the Romans. They were more concerned about the Jews who were leaving than the possibility of the Romans who were coming in. And if anyone did afford the least shadow of suspicion of such an intention, his throat was cut immediately. They would spy them, they thought somebody was going to try to swallow their gold and slip over the wall. They would cut their throat. But after the richer story, it proved all one to them whether they stayed in the city or attempted to get out, for they were equally destroyed in both cases. For every such person was put to death under this pretense they were going to desert, but in reality, the robbers might get what they had. It got so bad in the city that there were the baser sort. These robbers would find somebody rich, and they'd say, "Aha, you're going to desert, aren't you?" And they'd cut his throat and then raid his house. So Josephus said it's a pretense. There was no indication they were going to desert. They were just a mob, just wanted their money. Yes.
Where's the saying Josephus?
This part of the truth. This is Josephus, book 5, chapter 10. The madness of the seditious, that is, the revolutionaries, it also increased together with their famine. By the way, an uncultured man, or an uneducated man, a crude man, who gets hungry, you've got a very dangerous animal on your hands. It's interesting that in history, this isn't going to cost anything, but you have examples of ascetics, religious ascetics, highly cultured, highly educated men who would go without food or go with very little food to the point of starving themselves to death over a long period of time. Some even did starve themselves to death. But a man who had little education, little culture, little religion, simply cannot. When he finds himself without food, he becomes like an animal. It's interesting that better educated people, whose minds are broader, whose instincts are deeper, people of deep faith and commitment, find it much easier to discipline the body than people who are less educated, less broad, less deep in their faith. Interesting, Kenneth Roberts, the famous, wrote the book Northwest Passage about America, historical novel, great book. Anyway, in this famous raid of Rogers Rangers against St. Francis, this is roughly based on history, or sort of fictionalized history. Anyway, the author of the book, it was fiction, was a young man who was educated. He was an artist, and he was the only one. Most of the Rogers Rangers were frontiers. He could not read or write. They were very limited in their training. They were frontiersmen. They were good. This young man was in the city, and he to make a long story short, they raided St. Francis, the whole out of the French and Indians, and the French are after them. And they have to walk back. Their boats have been found and destroyed. They walk back through one of the worst country in the world in the wintertime. There's a very little chance any of them will get back. And so Rogers, who's this figure who's leading them, he breaks them into small detachments. And he puts this young man with a detachment of rangers. And he said, "Now, I want you to, you're responsible to get these men back." He said, I'm going to trust you because you've got an education. You've got a reason to get back. So you'll make it. But the rest of them, they don't have a good reason to get back, and they won't make it. But it's up to you to pull them along and keep them going. Well, anyway, what they found was that these seditious, when they were without food, they became very, very bad. Human behavior becomes, that is, you often hear this, in time of crisis, you see people what they really are, they're noble. What happened in the power failure in New York? Some people who never do not even speak to their neighbors will help them out, take care of one another. And what do others do? Loot. Take advantage of the situation to loot. Anyway, the kind of thing happened. The madness of the seditious did also increase together with their family. That's what he's saying.
as the hunger they got, the worse they got. And both those miseries were every day inflamed more and more, for there was no corn which anywhere appeared publicly. But the robbers came running into and searched men's private houses. If they found none, they tormented them worse, because they supposed that they had more carefully concealed it. Just break into somebody's house, can't food? No, well, they didn't believe them. They would assume that they'd hid it. The indication they made use of whether they had any or not was taken from the bodies of those miserable wretches, which, if they were in good case, that is, if they looked like they'd been eating, they supposed they were in no want at all of food. They were wasted away, and they walked out off without searching any further. This person, you know, all skin and bones, they would assume, well, if you had any food, you was eating it. Obviously, you shouldn't eat anything. So, they'd leave them alone. Nor did they think it proper to kill such as these, because they saw that they would very soon die themselves for want of food. That is, why bother killing them about dead? Many there were indeed who sold what they had for one measure, it was of wheat, if they were the richer sort, but of barley if they were poor. But these had so done, they shut themselves up in the inmost rooms of their houses and ate the corn they had gotten. Some did without grinding it, by reason of the extremity of the want they were in. Others baked bread of it. According as necessity and fear dictated to them, a table was nowhere laid for a distinct meal. But they snatched the bread out of the fire, half-baked, and ate it very hastily. They couldn't wait to grind the corn. Even when they did bake it, they couldn't wait for the bread to be baked. They would snatch it from the fire. They were so hungry. It was now a miserable case. I'm thinking of it because Jesus talked about how miserable it was for Jerusalem. Jesus saw all this when he wept over the city. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that stonest the prophets, kill us those that are sent to the offering, but I've gathered thee unto myself, and came gather their chicks under wings, which you would not. Now in your habitation, you're left desolate. And we're reading about this. In other words, we're reading about some of the reasons that Jesus wept over the city. That's the reason, of course. It was now a miserable case, and a sight that would justly bring tears into our eyes. How men stood as to their food, while the more powerful had more than enough, and the weaker were lamenting for one of it. But the famine, that is, the strong were taking it from the weak. But the famine was too hard for all other passions, and it is destructive to nothing so much as to modesty. For what was otherwise worthy of reverence was in this case despised, insomuch that children pulled the very morsel that their fathers were eating out of their very mouths. And what was still more to be pitied, so did mothers do as to their infants. Mother would find a bit of food to give it to their baby, and the last minute, overcome by their own hunger, snatch the food from their baby's mouth, fool themselves. That's why he says things that were normally people would reverence, like caring for your child, like good to do it. And when those that were most dear, were perishing under their hands, as their children, they were not ashamed to take from them the very last drops that might preserve their lives. And while they ate after this manner, yet were they not concealed in so doing. But the seditious everywhere came in upon them immediately, and snatched away from them what they had gotten from others. And when they saw any house shut up, this was to them a signal that the people within had gotten some food. Whereupon they broke open the doors, and ran in and took pieces of what they were eating, almost out of their very throats, and this by force. The old men who held their food fast were beaten. And if the women hid what they had within their hands, their hair was torn for so doing. Nor was there any commiseration shown either to the aged or to infants. But they lifted up children from the ground as they hung upon the morsels. That is, the child had a piece of bread, and they would take the bread and lift the child up, still clinging to it. From the ground as they hung upon the morsels they had gotten, and shook them down upon the floor. But still were they more barbarously cruel to those that had prevented their coming in, that is, had locked the door and bolted it, and actually swallowed down what they were going to seize upon, as if they had been unjustly defrauded of their right. They also invented terrible methods of torment to discover where any food was, and they were these. And then anyway, he tells about the way they were tortured in horrible ways to tell them to get them to tell. These were Jews doing this to Jews to get them to tell where the food was.
That's what I was going to say. Were these the bandits?
This is the mob. The hungry mob.
I just don't see how they ever expected to stand up and get your wounds to start out with.
Well, You should understand, once Titus was there, they were done for anyway. Didn't know. The man's already given himself up for dead.
Titus would kill him anyway?
Oh, yeah. They're ordered slaves the rest of their life. Remember, I said that Nero used slaves who were taken from Jerusalem, Jewish slaves, to help build the temple there at Corinth? Afraid of him. He'll go right through you. Afraid of this. A terrified man will kill you. Well, these were cornered men. And nowhere to go. That's one of the reasons why Israel could make such good soldiers. Why Israel never retreats? They got order to retreat too. Going naked. It's amazing how hard you'll fight when you got nowhere to go. And the Jews, of course, were trapped. They had nowhere to go. And they faced nothing but death or slavery, execution, crucifixion. That's how they split up your own. Amazing what a desperate man will do. Well, anyway, you get the picture? Terrible. Josephus goes into detail, yes.
Was Joseph in the city?
Yeah, he was in the city.
First they were Galilee.
Remember I said after the dust settled, he went to Rome. What I meant was, what he did was, he came down. The Romans let him come down to attempt to talk the Jews into surrendering. Yeah. He went through it, yeah. Whether he survived. Josephus had an amazing capacity to survive. I'm not sure exactly how he did it. Well, anyway, I'm skipping on. Is this interesting thing? This is what Jesus prophesied in Matthew 24. Let me skip on. Now Titus' banks were advanced a great way. The banks were the earthen ramps put up against the walls so they could scale them. Notwithstanding, his soldiers had been very much distressed from the wall. He then sent a party of horsemen in order that they should lay ambushes for those that went out into the valleys to gather food. People during the night and slip out and cover darkness, try to slip through the lines. Some of these were indeed fighting men who were not contented with what they got by rapine, that is, by stealing. But the greater part of them were poor people who were deterred from deserting by the concern that they were under for their own relations, that is, they had women and children, families didn't want to leave behind. They could not hope to escape. In other words, you might say, well, if I got through the line to get food, why would they go back into the city? Why would they just keep going? Well, the fighting men, he said, these are not just fighting men who would go out and get food and come back in to help defend the city. But most of these were people who went to get food for their families. Were in the city, therefore they would go through the line, try to find food in the countryside, and sneak back into the city. And so the Romans started looking for them. As in the severity of the famine made them bold in thus going out, so nothing remained but that when they were concealed from the robbers, they should be taken by the enemy. It's just getting worse. You had any food in the city, the robbers got it, the mob, you went out, the Romans got you. And when they were going to be taken, they were forced to defend themselves for fear of being punished. As after they had fought, they thought it too late to make any supplications for mercy. That is, once they were caught, they just fight tooth and nail because they thought, well, nothing to lose. So they were first whipped and then tormented with all sorts of tortures before they died and were then crucified before the wall of the city. This miserable procedure made Titus greatly to pity them while they caught every day 500 Jews. Nay, some days they caught more. Now, you can't. Josephus is not too trustworthy in his numbers. I think it would probably be more accurate to say every day they caught a large number. But probably not 500. Some days they caught more. Yet did it not appear to be safe for them to let loose those that were taken by force to go their way and set a guard over so many. He saw would be to make such as guarded them useless to them. That is, the real problem. They kept coming out. They're dying of starvation. So every day, several hundred of them perhaps would try to sneak through the lines in the night to get food. And so he would catch them. What was he going to do with them? Well, he thought he didn't want to let them go because this would not strike terror in the hearts of the people. Some of them had money, as we've already said, and he felt his purpose of being there was to punish the Jews. The Jews were not a military threat to Rome. The whole idea of doing this was to make an example of the Jews. And yet, he couldn't keep them alive you know, as prisoners. Why? Well, he says because it takes so many soldiers to guard them, and these soldiers who were guarding them were then useless to the battle. So what did he do? Kill them and nail them up on crosses for everybody to see. That is, put them on so people looking over the wall can see them. This is what's in store for you. The main reason why he did not forbid that cruelty, even seriously, Titus didn't like this. He didn't like the idea of killing these people, starving people. But he said, I have enough soldiers to guard them, can't let them go, can't keep them, can't let them go. What am I going to do? Kill them. And then he hoped the Jews might perhaps yield at that sight, the bit of all these bodies nailed to these crosses, out of fear lest they might themselves afterwards be liable to the same cruel treatment. Thought it might encourage them to surrender. So the soldiers, out of the wrath and hatred they bore the Jews, nailed those that they caught one after one way, another after another, to the crosses, by way of jest. That is, some upside down, all kinds of strange postures, you know, the bodies in all different positions. When their multitude was so great that there were so many of them who were being treated this way, that room was wanting for the crosses, and crosses wanting for the bodies. There was not enough crosses for bodies, and not enough room for the crosses. Maybe slight exaggeration. Apparently several hundred at one time, the Jewish bodies nailed them all kinds of positions, upside down, stretched in all different ways, on display before the city. Remember now, you know what Jesus said, well, when you see this country, get out. You don't want to be in on this.
When Jesus said there'd be wars and rumors of wars, was that all the stuff there?
Yes, it was some of the events leading up to where I talked about some of it. Well, the count goes on several pages in Josephus. Let me come toward the end of it. Now, those that perished by famine in the city, the number was prodigious. I've skipped several pages now. The number was prodigious, and the miseries they underwent were unspeakable. For if so much as the shadow of any kind of food anywhere up here, a war was commenced presently. The dearest friends fell fighting one after another about it, snatching from each other the most miserable supports of life. And he goes on telling that they ate everything. They ate their shoes, the leather off their shield they ate. Wisp of old hay became food to some. And then Josephus says, I'm going to say the worst of all. He said, things really got bad. But he said, now I'm going to tell you, this is the pit. This is absolute worst. A certain woman that dwelt beyond Jordan, her name was Mary. Her father was Eleazar, goes on and tells about this family. She's caught in the city. This poor woman was set upon by the robbers, and they took her food. They weren't even merciful enough, they said, to kill her. And so she was dying, and she had a child. And she says finally to the child, O thou miserable infant, for whom shall I preserve thee in this war? Now this is really something. This is the mother looking down at the baby, and the baby sucking at her breast. She says, why am I trying to keep you alive? As to the war with the Romans, if they preserve our lives, we must be slaves. If we live, what have we got to live for? This famine also will destroy us even before that slavery comes upon us. By the way, this slavery, I mentioned that some of them were used to dig the canal and corn. Others were used. The Masada, I'll cover that next. They were used to build this earthen ramp, which you can still see today. If you go to the Masada today, when you go, you will see this dirt ramp, which was built by slave labor from these revolts in Jerusalem. And many hundreds died. Many of these were from Jerusalem. The famine also will destroy us even before the slavery comes upon us. Yet are these seditious rogues more terrible than both the other? That is, she said, why am I trying to keep you alive? If I do keep you alive, you just be in slavery. You'd be a miserable slavery. You're eventually going to die anyway. And even worse than the prospect of slavery, and worse than the famine, is this mob. which had treated her so badly. Come on thou, be thou my food, and be thou a fury to these seditious varlets, and a byword to the world, which is all that is now wanting to complete the calamities of the Jews. She gets cynical. She says, be thou my food, and we'll just show you how bad things can get. We're a hiss and a byword, we're to the nations will leave, but we might as well go all the way. Desperation, despair. As soon as she had said this, she slew her son, and then roasted him, and ate the one half of him, and kept the other half by her concealed. Upon this, the seditious, that is the mob, came in presently, and smelling the horrid scent of this food, they threatened her that they would cut her throat immediately if she did not show them what food she had gotten ready. The horrible smell of this child who cooked. She replied that she had saved a very fine portion of it for them, and withal uncovered what was left of her son. He was identified, just showing half the baby. Hereupon they were seized with a horror and an amazement of mind, and stood astonished at the sight. Even then, as hardened as they were, there was almost more than they could take. She said to them, "This is mine own son, and what hath been done was mine own doing. This is my child, and I killed him. I ate the other half. Come, eat of this food, for I have eaten of it myself. Do you pretend to be more tender than a woman, more compassionate than a mother?" And Jenny stomached for that. "I did. I'm the child's mother, and I eat the half. Surely you're eating the other half. You don't eat the child's mother. You're a bunch of tough old men. But if you be so scrupulous and do abominate this my sacrifice, as I have eaten the one half, let the rest be reserved for me also. If you don't, you can't take it. You just leave and I'll eat the other half too." After which those men went out trembling, being never so much afraid at anything as they were at this. And with some difficulty, they left the rest of the meat to the mother. And that, they were tempted to eat it. This sad instance, I'm skipping down now, was quickly told to the Romans, some of whom could not believe it. And others pitied the distress which the Jews were under. But there were many of them who were hereby induced to a more bitter hatred than ordinary of our nation. Their issue affected among the Romans, and they heard about this, some pitied the Jews, they were brought to this. But others said, "Why, it's true, these are filthy, worthless people. Any mother can kill their own child, cooking and eating. Why, they deserve everything they're getting." And they hated the Jews more, while others pitied them instead. Well, Josephus tells about this horrible event. This is what he's saying, is this is how bad things got. Well, we don't know. Josephus put the number way over a million. That's impossible. Several months
broke out. So the false
Messiah, or one Messiah, called upon, cried upon the Jordan River, so he would lead them across. But finally, when the money was taken from the temple treasury, the general revolt broke out. Vespasian subdued Galilee first, subdued the fortified communities or cities or towns, we would call them, to the south of Galilee. Finally, in AD 70, Vespasian had left his son Titus in charge. He laid siege to Rome. Within a few weeks, took Jerusalem. We had the last one to fall Jerusalem. By the way, you asked about Josephus. Josephus hid himself in a cavern. And you asked, I was very clear in my answer to one question. But he hid himself in a cavern and emerged after the fight was over. After the others. Yeah.
We mentioned many times that the Christians fled the city before the siege. Where did they go to, or do we know?
Just out in the outlying districts. Probably they went into the Judean hills, maybe some of the communities down in here. I don't even know where they went. They may have crossed over the Transjordan in Arabia area. There are plenty of areas to go to get out of the fire. You see, one of the things that, you study war, ancient history, medieval history, even up through modern times, you get a very false impression. when you read about an army conquering a country, taking this town, taking that town, laying siege here, you often have this vision in your mind of a country totally laid waste. You know, the war, see, even in Asia, even modern times, warfare leaves most areas untouched. War tends to be very localized, so the battles are fought. Now, for instance, you would find in even the Second World War, where there was a tremendous amount of destruction of property for the armies, people often conjure up in their minds visions of Europe being bombed out, either by the Allies or by the Axis forces. Not true. Major industrial cities were bombed out. That's it. Or cities that were in the line of march, there would be active military activity. But even with the great destruction of World War II, there were large areas of Europe that were untouched as far as actual destruction. So we often get the impression of, the general involvement of the country in a war, especially in ancient, it wasn't true. The fortified towns, yes, but there would be vast areas that would never see the foot of a soldier. So there was plenty of places to go.
This idea is perpetuated then considerably by our accounts of the Old Testament, where they got hold and go in and slay everyone. I think we probably conquered that type of thing.
Yes, the slave, if there was a slave one that could. You see, very seldom in the history of warfare has the whole of a large country been involved in the warfare. There's not enough soldiers to go around. Especially the ancient armies were not as big as the historians tend to say. See, the ancient historians, you see that says this, they tend to use numbers not as counts, but as sort of general adjectives. Often you'll say, there was 15,000 men fell on that day. Well, now, they didn't have a body count. And by the way, even in modern warfare, where they're careful, whole units of men whose sole job is to record the dead and the wounded, very imprecise records. For instance, with every major war has produced thousands of missing actions, unaccounted for. Well, the ancients didn't even try. They didn't go out to try to really count. Although, the exception is in Marathon, some of the Greeks would, the national war, as opposed to one of the mercenary forces. But what they would tend to use the numbers, if there was a large number of people, there was a big engagement, they would just pull a big number out of the hat. And people didn't understand, the ancients didn't understand that this represented a body count or a head count. Simply, they would say, there was a large number. And very often they exaggerated because they were using it as a literary device. That's what they counted. And often what they would do is, if they won the battle, the chroniclers, the historians, the guys on our side, if they won a great battle, they tended to overemphasize the number on the other side. Because the more you defeat it, the better it sounded for your side. For instance, we know that Josephus' number Josephus wanted to indicate the terrible slaughter of the Jews in Jerusalem. Well, the number he gives is absurd. If they were standing shoulder to shoulder, front to back, maybe you could have got that many people in the city. But he was emphasizing, he didn't go around town. We have no way of knowing how many people were in the city. Around the computer, with the calculator, you could count. Like, you're going to count baby chickens in the yard? Well, anyway, okay. Any other questions? Remember I talked about the Sicarii? Who were the Sicarii? They were the most extreme of the zealots. They were the assassins. They went around assassinating the Romans. They went around assassinating Jews whom they suspected of being collaborating with the Romans. These were the most avid. The Sicarii were the most zealous zealots. For the last to hold out against the Romans, they held out at a place you're unfamiliar with, a place called the Silence, right?
Chair.
right here. Masada. That's right on the map. Now, yeah, you saw pictures of this. You pictured the Dr. Henderson. Basically, what it was AD 73. Remember, Jerusalem fell AD 70. Masada did not fall until AD 73.
So these Sicarii, are they flown from Jerusalem down to the bottom?
They were forces that were on the move. And what they did in AD 66, either Sicarii or some other Jewish zealots, there was a Roman garrison on Masada. See, Herod had a house there. But we don't know how, probably because it was a very small Roman garrison, and they did it by surprise. But anyway, in AD 66, a group of Jews, probably Sicarii, destroyed or conquered the Roman garrison on Masada. We would call Masada in our country today, in our desert, a butte. I think it's a butte, a mesa, I'm not sure about all these, but it's a high projection of land with a natural fortress flat on top of it.
What year did you say they conquered?
AD 66. The Roman garrison was run out of Masada, and the Jews controlled it. What they were doing, all during the Jewish wars, while Jerusalem was under siege, they would harass the enemy and retreat to Masada. Go out, raid, kill, and then beat them back to Masada. Now, Masada had been originally fortified by Jonathan the high priest back during the Maccabean War. The Jews had used it as a fortress against the Syrians. And Josephus tells, we're going to see, that some of the food that was left there by Jonathan the high priest, by his forces, and stored some food there that was still edible. That was 180 years later. That sound outlandish? Well, it isn't, because when the Yigia Yadin excavated Masada, and I'll show you a picture of this, when we get to it, they found foods that's still edible. For almost 2,000 years.
Tasty,
but they're still identifiable. So preserved. Because of the high, dry climate. Yes.
You said it was used in the fortress against who?
By the Maccabean. Remember talking about the Maccabean revolt against the Syrians. It's been used. And then Herod, who was always, he needed a good fortress, Herod fortified it and built two palaces on this flat butte, we would call it. And he, and you saw pictures of this, he did it for two reasons. First of all, he the fortress against, faced again, he was worried about the Egyptians, and it was down this way, and they had to fight the Egyptians. And secondly, the Jews were always out to get him. And so, he did what most modern dictators do. They always have an escape plan. The Nazis did it. Most of the leaders of Nazi Germany, when they saw the handwriting on the wall, 3 years before the war was over, they set up an organization called the Odessa Organization, which set up false alternate identities, Swiss bank accounts, South American bank accounts, and escape routes. So that the Jew, his name is Nazi Hunter, still doing he spent his life hunting them down, most of them in South Central America. There's two or three major criminals left, Mingles and some other.
What's his name? I know. It's not too new, I think.
But anyway, the escape route. Now, and most dictators have done this. Interesting, the Shah of Iran used America. He saw a Pingo was coming, so he bought an estate in Los Angeles and it's all ready to go. Well, this is what Herod used Masada for, just in case they think that that is a place to go.
So if the car were like the underground type Jews were after those,
yeah,
who were in?
Well, they were not necessarily underground. They were just the
the most rapid revolutionary.
There are those because of the involvement of the Druids. Were they upset at the Romans because of the Jerusalem?
No, they were fighting the Romans all during the time. See, they were not in Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. Many of them were not in Jerusalem. This was a stronghold of them. There were many strongholds of Jewish resistance. The Romans wiped them out systematically. Jerusalem was the main one, but there were some left, and Masada was the last one, for obvious reasons, because it was farther south, because of the nature of the terrain. They were fighting the Romans all during the time the Romans were trying to seize Jerusalem.
Did they succeed in
that? Succeeded in killing a lot of Romans.
How long did it take the Solomon to fall?
It took him 1 year, but about a little less than a year. Now, Josephus gives the a description of Masada. Let me read the description of Josephus of Masada. Anyway, he sets the stage. This is, if you want to reference his war in Jews 7, 8. Book 7, chapter 8. When Bassus was then in Judea, Flavius Silva. Now, Flavius Silva was the Roman general who laid siege to Masada, whereas Titus had been the Roman general who laid siege to Jerusalem. Succeeded him as a procurator there, who, when he saw that all the rest of the country was subdued in this war, now there was but one only stronghold that was still in rebellion. He got all his army together, which was the 10th Legion, by the way. The old 10th Legion was an experienced, battle-hardened legion. They knew what they were doing. And by the way, the soldiers that were putting down rebellions tended to be meaner than soldiers who fought in what we would call conventional war. Because in conventional wars, armies tended to fight according to, quote, the rules. But in rebellion, we have a civilian uprising, they tend to resort to all kinds of dirty tricks. And soldiers always thought that was pretty unfair. I mean, you know, that they thought it was fair enough a guy wants to kill you, he gets out and challenges you, he faces you, and he's in his uniform, and you're in your uniform, and he's got his weapons. At your weapons, and you fight out to the death. Okay, it's not great, but it's acceptable. You find somebody who locks you, who bolts you, who barricades your doors, and sets fire to your house in the middle of the night when you're asleep, and burns up, you know, your wife and children. That's not kosher. Neither is the Roman. And so you get the point, or steps up and then behind you in a busy marketplace, or such a knife. So when these soldiers, by the way, you see this, they were particularly vicious, tough soldiers. One of the reasons they would wipe out the civilian population was for their own survival. It was one of the problems they had in Vietnam. The thing that makes a war harder to fight than anything else is nothing to do with the Indian. Now, we see the same thing, by the way, with a certain parallel. When the soldiers who destroyed the Mexican army under Santana, who destroyed the Alamo, had been soldiers who had been put down, they were hardened soldiers who had been putting down rebellion in Mexico. And it was a tough army. It was helped us understand why the people of Masada entered their suicide pact. But they're punished for their, you see, it's one thing. There's two. Up till in modern Western Europe warfare, in medieval Europe, very often the object of war was to defend your country or establish a principle. And sometimes the purpose of war was to punish. And when the purpose of the war was to punish someone, then it really got dirty. Now you see, by the way, you see this in World War, you see a contrast in this in World War I and World War II. World War I, the Western power defeated Germany. But when Germany saw that all was lost, Germany sued for the terms of peace, and they were granted. And the German industrial complex was left intact. Germany itself was not touched by the war.
France was torn all pieces. Germany was relatively untouched. As soon as Germany said, hey, you win, they said, okay, they drew peace, and they got away home. That is why, in the Second World War, the Allies demanded unconditional surrender. Now, see, the First World War was ended with a conditional surrender. The Second World War was fought with a view to punish it, and to bring up and to require unconditional surrender, which the Allies achieved. That is, total defeat. You dismantle the enemy's, where you dismantle the enemy's capacity to wage war. Now you see a kind of a conflict in modern times. So, this is kind of a minor point, but I want us to see, get to get in prospect here, that what we see here in this Jewish war, the Romans, this 10th legion, which is what Silvia brought to, the Silva, Silva brought to, Flavius Silva brought to Curtis Masada. It was bad business. For one thing, this ramp that we're going to talk about, a great ramp that was built at the side of Masada, was built by slaves, by Jewish slaves who had already been conquered. And all you had to know what was going to happen to you if you lost, all you had to do was look over the side, down at your countrymen who were working themselves to death building this ramp. Very vivid optic lesson that was in store for you. So, the Sicarii, as we say, when they took it, there were plenty of supplies up there, both from the Romans and from the earlier use of it by Jonathan the high priest. And so, there was plenty of food and water and weaponry. That was never the problem. And plus they had been fortifying it themselves. The leader was Eleazar, a powerful man, and the commander of these Sicarii that had seized upon it. Eleazar ben Yair. He was the leader, and quite a fellow. Well, anyway, we read this description of Masada by Josephus. There was a rock not small in circumference and very high. By the way, Masada stood. The top of Masada is 1,300 feet from the shore, from the water of the Dead Sea. Now, it's not 1,300 feet from the top and bottom in every point around it, but that gives you an idea how high it is. At any point, it was several hundred feet. You know, at any point where you wanted to go up there, you were looking almost straight up for a long way, a sheer cliff almost, tip of the one side where there was a serpentine path where one man worked himself to death almost. But that was almost as good. You got a narrow path like that. Three men could do that.
What was Eleazar then? What?
Yair. Y-A-I-R. Okay.
It was encompassed with valleys of such vast depth downward that the eye could not reach their bottom.
It couldn't see all the way to the bottom. That's true. Remember John Bunyan? Remember Paul Bunyan? The great lumberjack used to tell stories. He found a tree one time that was so high that three men could see the top. I see this is the Paul Bunyan school of exaggeration. But you see, now keep in mind, and by the way, this is where this gets into, I wish I had time to give a certain lectures on this. So many people get into trouble interpreting scripture because they interpret it in our literary context, but in the literary context which is written. And this is written in the same literary context, historically speaking, as the New Testament. And often, language is not in ancients. Especially the people of the East, did not use language exactly the way we do. Very so different. For instance, when he said it was so deep that the eye could not reach the bottom, he was not saying that it's impossible to stand at the top and not see the bottom. What he was saying is very, very deep. And they also have been suggesting there were areas around the edge where you could, kind of like River Grand Canyon, you can stand on one of cliffs, one of the flatters at the top, and you can see all the way down, but you can't see over and down, you know, to the very bottom. So it's the nebby what he's talking about. It was very high. They were abrupt, that is, perpendicular, such as no animal could walk upon, excepting at two places of the rock where it subsides in order to afford a passage for ascent, though not without difficulty. Now, the way that they took, one is that from the lake Asphaltitis, from which we get our word asphalt, an ancient name for the Dead Sea.
the asphalt leg was put in a hitch floating on top of it. Toward the sun rising, that is the east, and another on the west, where the ascent is easier, but one of these ways is called a serpent, as resembling that animal in its narrowness and its perpetual windings. Broken path, the switchbacks of it. For it is broken off at the prominent precipices of the rock and returns frequently into itself. You know, you wind around, all of a sudden you walk 55, 60 feet and gone 3 feet. Like the Mississippi River sometimes. The Mississippi River, they used to do that. Were they damaged? There were several towns who would part do it. One decade they'd be in Missouri, and the next decade they'd be in Illinois. Or Arkansas or somewhere. The river would just change course and run it up. And they used to wind so like the horseshoes that they would, it was very common. They got the lower Mississippi that people would be going down these big rivers and they would have big horseshoes. They go 6 or 8 miles around this way and come back and be a quarter of a mile back to here. So people all get off and have picnics and party and walk this short distance to get back on the boat. And people get all the way around. Anyway, he says the path is like this. You often, you know, you go wind around and come back right back almost where you started. But which gives an indication, you know, it's pretty common, that it's easier to be descended. That's finding the way up there. It's not just winding and narrow, it's steep. That an animal could really make it up. Well, time to take away. There is also nothing but destruction in case your feet split. What does that mean? if you fall, you panic. For on each side there was a vastly deep chasm and precipice sufficient to quell the courage of everybody by the terror it infused into the mind. Considering the Romans didn't even try to go up that way. They never tried. The way it was possible to not really walk up, scratch and claw your way up, fight your way up, dig your way up. When therefore a man hath gone along this way for 30 furlongs, the rest is the top of the hill, not any in a small point, but is no other than a plain upon the highest part of the mountain. Upon this top of the hill, Jonathan the high priest is the plain of his flat. First of all, built a fortress and called it Masada, after which the rebuilding of this place employed the care of King Herod to a great degree. He goes on to tell about that. What was found there? Well, as for the furniture, now this word furniture doesn't mean chairs and tables, it means supplies, what it was furnished with. As for the furniture, so I don't like this translation, as for the furniture that was within this fortress, it was still more wonderful on account of its splendor and long continuance. For here was laid up corn in large quantities, and such as would subsist men for a long time. Here was also wine and oil in abundance, of all kinds of pulse, that's vegetables, veggies, and dates, heaped up together. All of which Eleazar found there when he and his Sicarii got possession of the fortress by treachery. These fruits were also fresh and full ripe, and no way inferior to such fruits newly laid in, although they were a little short of 100 years in the limit of his provisions. I overestimated this before. Well, anyway, still, 100 years from the place you're thinking about the Romans. Nay, indeed, when the Romans got possession of these fruits that are left, they found them not corrupted at all. While, Lord, should we be mistaken if we suppose that the air was here the cause of their enduring so long, and so forth. So it tells about the food that was still there. Now, Flavius Silva came and put up camp, and he, first thing he did was he built a wall around all around the base of Masada, so no Jew could get out. Because what they were doing, they were slipping down at night, going out and raiding, living back in. So he stopped that. Thus he set up this camp. The Roman camp was like a miniature village. It was a fully functioning social unit, everything they needed, shop. And you can stand at the top of the Masada today and see the outlines of these camps. It surrounded the major camps. There he had the 10th legion, plus he had, which was the hardcore fighting men. Plus he had auxiliary troops. Auxiliary troops were the viewers of wood, you know, they took care of the equipment, took care of the food, the rear echelon troops. Plus, thousands of prisoners of war, many of them had been taken from Jerusalem. This was 72. About a year and a half, it fall of Jerusalem. And he proceeded to go to Rome. Now you all seen the picture of Masada. Look something, if you look at, I think from the east, but something like this. The Dead Sea down here. And he
percent developed, that they had the place where it was highest, where we, you know, at least drop from the edge to the bottom, and said they could build a ramp up there.
Go ahead.
Same thing you see, by the way, building a modern superhighway, we're going across those areas where the valley will be filled in. There's a tremendous amount of earth. Well, imagine doing that by hand. How many people died in that? How this would encourage the defenders of the already set on the top to hold out.
Now, Silva, what he did was he ordered great battering rams. First he built the ramp up. Now the purpose of the ramp was to move not simply men, but mainly the battering rams, the machines. Because there was a wall around the lip of Masada. So what the Jews did, they built a wall inside the wall. And this wall was a strange combination. They made it of wood. And with earth, like, kind of like a form, with earth, wood supported with earth. And I'm going to guess why they did that. Because in the battering ram, they would give. And not brick. Instead, they pack it harder and harder. So they had reinforced the wall, really built a second wall, mounted it. And so when the Roman battering rams came against it, this wood and cake would give against this earth and absorb the force of the rams, the battering rams. And so they, it was almost impossible to knock it down. So the Romans simply set fire to it. And it burned. Well, as Josephus tells, the day after it burned, those who were on the inside, almost confounded, knew that the next morning would see the Romans on the side, which had already come down. Because the wall at that point, top of the ramp, had been pushed through, and the Romans would simply bring up a sufficient force, manual batting, whatever they needed, and they were going to push their way in. They were fighting. There was no way to stop them. That is, they knew they would probably kill many Romans. They would probably kill, there were not almost 1,000 Jewish people in all fighting men, including women and children. And while the Romans would probably lose, I would just guess, maybe 2,000 or 3,000 men in assault, the Romans didn't care. What they would do is they'd send some cannon fodder in. But the Jews knew that even though they would kill many Romans, maybe not that many, they knew they would kill many Romans. But they knew that there was no way to keep the Romans out.
Didn't Silva, when he first started that ramp, use Roman auxiliaries and whatnot, and they were letting arrows down on them? That's why he brought the Jews in, so they would kill the Romans.
I believe
I could
be right. Therefore, the Roman commander Silva had now built a wall on the outside round about this whole place. As we have said already, and had thereby made a most accurate provision to prevent any of the besieged running away. He undertook the siege himself, though he found but one single place that was near the bank to raise the ramp. For being from behind that tower which secured the road that led to the palace and to the top of the hill from the west, there was a certain eminency of the rock, very broad and very prominent, but 300 cubits beneath the highest part of Masada. Which meant it was 18 inches, about 400 feet on that. Accordingly, he got upon that part of the rock, and that is the place where it was the least distance up, and had a good, strong, firm jumping off place, so they could start with a starting place. When they fell to that work of the varsity, as bringing earth, you ordered the army to bring earth,
are you right?
And then do this for a while. And when they fell to that work of velocity, an abundance of them together, the bank was raised and became solid for 200 cubits in height. Yet was not this bank thought sufficiently high for the use of the machines of the engines that were to be set upon it. Still another elevated work of gray stones compacted together was raised upon that bank. This was 50 cubits both in breadth and height. The other machines we now got ready were like to those that had been first devised by this patient afterward by Titus Procedure. There was also a tower, that is, the ramp did not go all the way to the top. They built a ramp up to as close as they could get, and they built towers to it. Combination tower war machine on top of the ramp that let them give them access to the wall. Well, let's see. No, he doesn't mention it. Here it is. If the Romans begin to bombard them, it doesn't say. Okay. Now, the night before, this is a very stirring scene, Elias Vigneur makes the famous speech. He said, the enemy's outside.